KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
Well, he did suck on my finger. Yeah, he went to shake my hand, I thought, but it was actually to grab my hand and suck on my finger. He's kind of testing you.
Filmmakers Alison Burke and Frank Corradwan describe their first encounter with John Wadowitz, the bank robber who inspired the Al Pacino movie Dog Day Afternoon. And that was just the beginning of a 10-year adventure making their documentary, The Dog. But first on the news banter, we check in on Toronto and talk about why A&E would cancel its second most popular show. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
And Matt, you just came back from Toronto, where the festival is winding down, the film festival, a big launching pad oftentimes for Oscar movies, but also movies that just want to make money.
Yeah, there are several acquisition deals this year at the festival, but none bigger than this Chris Rock movie, Top Five, which got a $12.5 million deal from Paramount.
Which is striking because Paramount, you know, is not the studio known for its largesse, generally speaking, and $12.5 million is a lot of money. This is a comedy with Chris Rock playing a comic who wants to reinvent himself as a serious actor.
Yeah, unlike most of the festival movies that often are dark or dependent on awards caliber performances, this is a straight up gut busting comedy, Chris Rock at his best. And, you know, when you see a mainstream commercial play at a film festival, studios tend to jump on that.
So this was definitely a bidding war and the biggest splash at the festival. And otherwise, we just kind of solidified our sense about what's going to be an awards contention a bit.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there were no huge revelations or breakouts, but I think The Imitation Game starring Benedict Cumberbatch as a World War II codebreaker, that got a lot of buzz. Wild with Reese Witherspoon got a lot of buzz for her performance. The Theory of Everything, which is a Stephen Hawking biopic, that got a lot of buzz as well. But beyond that, there was no Gravity, there was no 12 Years a Slave, where everyone said, wow, this is the film to beat.
So we'll see what some films probably are in Oscar contention in some major categories. But so far, I think Boyhood hangs in there and some of these other films come onto the field.
Yeah, it's kind of a wide open race at this point.
Meanwhile, not in awards contention, The Amazing Spider-Man. The Daily Beast did an interview with Andrew Garfield. And the question that was posed to him was that they didn't like the movie that much. It seemed like a setup for the Sinister Six spinoff that Sony has planned. And Andrew Garfield really seemed to actually be somewhat hurt by the reaction to the film, not just that critic, but the general reaction, that it really wasn't as good as it could have been.
Yeah, and it was a surprisingly candid answer from him, because you rarely see the star of a big studio franchise actually criticizing some of the choices that the studio made on the film, saying that originally there were more emotional moments and things that made more sense to him, and some of the studio demanded cuts were upsetting to him.
Yeah, he said, once you start removing things and saying, no, that doesn't work, then the thread of the film is broken and it's hard to go with the flow of the story. That's a quote. And he said certain people at the studio had problems with certain parts of it. And ultimately, the studio is the final say in these movies because they're tentpoles. So you have to answer to those people.
Yeah, that's a big rebuke of the Sony studio, because that studio has managed the Spider-Man franchise pretty well over the years. And to have the star of the franchise now criticizing some of the choices, not ideal.
Meanwhile, Michael Lynton, who is the CEO of Sony Entertainment, almost, it seemed to me, sort of at the same time obliquely acknowledging problems at a Goldman Sachs conference, talking about the decline in summer box office at the U.S. this year, and that we've talked about before, it's a big problem. And he was saying that he feels that studios need to go beyond the kind of material they're making. He possibly could be talking about his own movie, The Amazing Spider-Man.
One of the interesting things he said was that there were too many similar movies being offered, but he's one of the biggest proprietors of that similarity in Amazing Spider-Man 2, which people felt was very similar to the first Amazing Spider-Man. The other thing he said, which was kind of bizarre, was that the box office would be helped if there were more romantic comedies, which there haven't been, but there was actually a very high-profile romantic comedy this summer with Adam Sandler and Drew Barrymore in Blended, and it flopped.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that always is the case is that one movie doesn't necessarily stand for anything. thing. The movies have to be good, and the genre may be pretty secondary. Turning to television, a decision that has upset a lot of people who are fans of the A&E series Longmire, and this is a show about a sheriff in Wyoming who's sort of cagey and solves crimes. I'll admit I've never seen it, but it has a lot of fans. It's the second most popular show on A&E, and yet they're canceling it.
Yeah, 5.6 million viewers, and they're just not the right kind of viewers. They're older. They're about 60 years old on average, which is outside of that wheelhouse for advertisers.
Yeah, and so this is an argument that goes on and on about the age of the audience, and do baby boomers who are 60 or more or in that neighborhood, you know, have such set habits in terms of their purchases that advertisers want nothing to do with them and they're chasing the kids while they're still out spending money and malleable? Or is the reality that baby boomers have money and are not really so set in their ways as maybe an older generation was, you know, 30, 40 years ago? And are these companies that are these advertisers and networks who are steering away from the older audience missing a boat?
I think the answer is probably both. I think a lot of these advertiser demos are probably outdated and that people are living longer and they have extended buying power further into their life. But you've got to go with what the advertisers want. And for A&E, that, like they said, this is a purely business decision and they have to watch what they're doing.
And there are two things going on, or more than two things, but two major financial things, one of which, as the Wall Street Journal pointed out, is that the cost, what you pay for a commercial on Longmire, a 30-second commercial, is $31,300. And meanwhile, a commercial on Mad Men, which is not a huge ratings grabber, $69,500, more than twice as much because of the view that this Longmire audience is big but not that compelling.
Right. And that's exactly the bottom line. And if, for instance, A&E owned Longmire or had a piece of Longmire, they would have an incentive to keep that show on the air because they could then sell it into syndication. They could sell it to Netflix and would share in that money. But they don't. Warner Brothers owns Longmire. So there's a reduced advertising price and there's no incentive to keep it because you don't get the back end on the show. So put two and two together and that's why it's canceled.
And they are trying to find another home for it, maybe on Netflix or Amazon. We'll see whether that can work out.
I think that Netflix or Amazon, you know, might be interested in a show like this because it has a built-in audience of people. And Netflix doesn't have to care about the advertising-friendly demo. They just have to get people to subscribe to their service. And if people really like Longmire, doesn't matter how old they are, if they're willing to pay $15 a month to get Netflix.
Well, meanwhile, I think you can binge the past seasons on Netflix. So maybe I'll take a look because I don't know what all the fuss is about. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter.
You're a city cop, right? Robbing a bank's a federal offense. They got me on kidnapping, armed robbery. They're going to bury me, man. I don't want to talk to somebody who's trying to calm me. Get somebody in charge here.
I am in charge.
I don't want to talk to some flunky pig trying to calm me, man.
You don't have to be calling.
What's he doing?
Will you get back over there?
What are you moving in there for?
Get over there, will you?
He wants to kill me so bad he can taste it.
Oh, God, I was going to kill
him. Attica! Attica! Attica!
Al Pacino was nominated for an Oscar for his performance in Sidney Lumet's 1975 classic Dog Day Afternoon. Pacino played a man who robs a Brooklyn bank to get money to pay for his lover's sex change operation. That story was based on real events, a 1972 robbery that turned into a hostage situation and an all-day media circus. The robber, the one who survived, that is, was John Wadowitz, the subject of The Dog, a new documentary by our guests Frank Corradrin and Allison Berg. As the filmmakers were to learn in intimate detail, Wadowitz was a fascinating and frustrating subject, a man with prodigious and unpredictable sexual appetites.
Okay, the reason I call myself a pervert is that I'm sexually oriented. It's very easy because you got to look at it this way. Most people drink, most people smoke, a lot of people do drugs, and they have sex. So they have all these outlets. Okay, I don't smoke, I don't drink, I don't do drugs, I don't gamble. So I'm an angel, but I got horns. Okay, and the trouble is when you got horns, you only can do one thing, okay? And that's
Berg and Corradrin went to work on their film more than a decade ago, and over the years they shot interviews with Wadowitz, his mother, and his brother, as well as his wives, his girlfriends, and his boyfriends. Through the years they worked on the film, their relationship to their subjects deepened, and their relationship to each other changed. So I just have to ask, are you two roommates? because
not currently, no.
No, so
no,
you were. I mean, I don't mean to pry, but I did read that you had come up with this idea when you were watching the movie Dog Day Afternoon, and I had the impression you were watching it together.
Yeah. Yeah, this is our test to see if people are paying attention.
Oh, did I pass?
Yeah. Yeah, no, we were together, and now we're filmmaking partners.
So, okay.
Yeah.
Sounds very civil
but
and
also
good.
At the time we were working on another film that we did that Allison directed, so we spent a good year and a half in an editing room. I think that's when we watched Dog Day Afternoon.
And you get this idea that this guy, the real guy, I think I also read that you thought he was about to get out of prison, which turned out to be not true.
Yeah, we added wrong. I don't really know how he did this, but
I do. I always add wrong, but don't feel bad.
Yeah, this whole film was created because of a simple math problem. Basically, there's a card at the end of Dog Day Afternoon that says that the real-life bank robber was sentenced to 20 years. So that should have been 1992, but somehow we made it 2002. And, you know, we thought we were coming up on him getting out of prison. But of course, like, we looked it up online and, you know, within minutes we realized he had been out since the late 70s. But, you know, we were already hooked by the story and by the character, and we really wanted to find the real-life guy.
And so you called his – he has a very – unusual name, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, basically, it was as simple as looking into the phone book, and we assumed that Brooklyn was the place to look, and perhaps even the first name we called. And his mother answered the phone. She was very nice. She's, you know, an elderly lady, and she didn't say much, but she made it sound like she's like, okay, you know, I'll pass the message on to my son when I speak to him. So we didn't know if it was going to be a few weeks or a month or whatever. And it turned out that very night the phone rang and the dog, John, called us in the middle of the night. And he was just, you know, immediately asked for a password, which we didn't know what the password was. It turned out to be the dog. And he was, you know, very curious about us, wanted to know a lot of stuff about us. The one thing we remember is that he said, I'm calling you back because my mother said you sounded sexy.
which one of you was he referring to?
Well, both. We don't really know. Probably Allison, actually. It was unusual from the first phone call. It was also a little creepy, perhaps. But I think it took about a month before we met him in person. And when we did, we met him in a public place in a diner in the morning on a Saturday, and he was like full of energy at 8 a.m. and jumped on us. I mean, he proceeded to like kiss my crotch and
oh no,
you know, he was very.
And
I mean,
you're
it was
like,
always
this is
like,
great. Like it's like simultaneously horrifying and intriguing, I guess. Right,
and we got close to our subject very quickly.
Yeah,
and it was okay.
Got very close. No, but you know, it was like it was more amusing than anything. It wasn't shocking. It was just very.
It wasn't
strange.
Shocking. A guy kisses your crotch in a coffee shop,
well,
or diner.
I mean, he was an unusual guy. You know, I didn't die from it. He didn't bite me or anything.
Well, he did suck on my finger, though.
Oh my God.
He went to shake my hand, I thought, but it was actually to grab my hand and suck on my finger. But
wow.
I think it's just he's kind of testing you, you know? He's seeing who can laugh at a joke and who's going to be open-minded. And, you know, there's some people who probably would have just, like, walked out of the diner,
yes.
Whereas we were just like, okay, he has us a little bit on our toes, but, I mean, he's hilarious. So and he's a great storyteller.
You know,
he's hazing
night,
you a little bit.
Yes.
Yeah.
From
yeah.
the jump, really. Okay, so yeah. he... I guess he then, I mean, does he then say, okay?
That first day that we met him, we knew we wanted to make the film, but it wasn't like we were scheduling a shoot the very next week. It was like getting to know him, getting to know his mom, them getting to know us, and sort of going from there. And then I think it just became like more organic, like eventually we scheduled the first shoot. But first they were checking us out and seeing if like we were going to kind of be his filmmaker buddies that get to make this film, because we're not the first ones to have this idea.
Mm. He had others had come and been turned
and
away.
And gone.
Mm-hmm.
And ran away.
Or ran, right, yes. Turned away, ran away. So how does it work? Because I think you were both working. I think, Allison, you were working as a producer in TV, and Frank, you were an editor.
Yeah, I mean, I direct and produce on TV, like doc series and specials. Frank edits, and so we were self-financing this film. So the first shoot, you know, we needed money for, and we kind of had like a little bit of money we put towards it, and we did like a proper two-day shoot. after that, it's like, you know, you're sort of running over to their apartment in Brooklyn. And we could kind of pull that off with borrowed cameras and once in a while somebody else coming with us. But we would basically run over there after work. And if we weren't going over, he'd want to talk all night. So he'd be calling our phones and, you know, it's like, all right, who's going to do it tonight? Because like we're just trying to catch up on some sleep at some point. So yeah. It was tricky, but we were also so immersed in their world. And a lot of what we talk about with people, sort of this idea of like a disappearing New York and characters from almost another time in New York. And we were aware of that when we were filming, like that we were with some really unique, very charismatic people, and we enjoyed it, you know, and we knew like this was sort of unusual and great. But then when we had to edit, that's really where the money situation got very tricky, because we'd go off and do these jobs. And for both of us, our jobs aren't necessarily short and they're all encompassing. So it's like, can we find 4 to 6 weeks to edit for a while together? I mean, it was really tricky. And that's part of the reason why it took so many years is, you know, when it's self-financed, we can never take a huge chunk of time and just work on the film.
I can't even imagine how you work full time and then do this. I just can't figure that out.
And then spend all of your money on it, too.
Yeah. I think the other thing that's important is if we were ever ready to give up, and I don't know that we were, but, you know, we were exhausted at times, the film just wouldn't go away. Like, John would not go away. We lived 20 minutes apart from each other, and
did you think about
even
moving?
If we weren't filming, well, yeah, no, I mean, it was a little bit of that. At some point, it was just this realization that you're like, oh, yeah, no, he's never gonna go away. But we, you know, we liked being with John, but at times, you know, you couldn't be with him all the time. It was just too difficult.
And you say self-financed. I mean, you never did the friends and family or looking around or trying to get somebody to support it?
Well, when we got into Toronto, this was about this time last year, we did a crowdfunder on a site called Student Spark. But, I mean, trying to finish a film while doing a crowdfunder was such a nightmare because we never even had an assistant editor on the film. And there was so much we had to do on our own that it was just really tricky to pull off. So that's when we had some help from friends and family. But it was sort of a drop in the bucket compared to what we had to put in all the years leading up to that.
Yeah, by then you'd already been through 10 years of struggle, basically.
But there's an interesting, I wouldn't say it's a lesson because it's not the course I would choose again, but, you know, money just buys you time so you can make films faster. But when you don't have the money, you can still make the film up until the end. Like Allison said, all the cost and the help came at the end, but you can still make the film. The thing is, it's just going to take a lot of time. And in this case, the fact that we put in all this time paid off in a way because we spent, you know, hundreds of evenings, if not thousands, with John, with his mother, with the other people that we filmed before we interviewed them. And I think ultimately you get to a whole other level of intimacy in the film. It's often, you know, more than you want to do. So when you're forced to do it, in a way, it's kind of like it paid off. And it gave us a lot of time to find all this archival footage and all the stills that are in the film, which we would have never found in a year.
Yeah, I mean, our original plan was to film for a year. And we would often say to each other, you know, we never would have met the dog's brother. His mother had never spoken to anybody about what had happened. None of that happened in the very first year. So that was the time spent. I mean, I think that we have something that goes much deeper and is much more meaningful. And also for us, not just as filmmakers, but as people, we had a real life experience that went way beyond just even making the film for us. I mean, we really had an experience that, I mean, we'll never forget. And there were real relationships we had with these people.
Coming up after a short break, Alison Berg and Frank Carradwin tell us how, after working on the dog for a decade, their film was suddenly underground and underwater, nearly destroyed by Superstorm Sandy. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Alison Berg and Frank Carradwin about their documentary, The Dog. The focus of their film is John Wadowitz, the bank robber portrayed by Al Pacino in Dog Day Afternoon. Wadowitz committed the crime to pay for his lover's gender reassignment surgery. And ultimately, he did pay for the operation by selling his story to Warner Brothers.
I'm like Babe Ruth, but I'm the gay Babe Ruth, right? I hit a home run. Know why I hit a home run? Because I beat the f***ing system. I won. I didn't lose. I won. Ernie got the sex change. Ernie lived. Ernie was happy. Ernie survived. And I'm happy for that.
After the filmmakers were several years into shooting the dog, Wadowitz was diagnosed with cancer. He passed away in 2006. Those developments are included in Corodrin and Berg's film, but they didn't want to dwell on them.
The reason we didn't really include too much of that in the film is that, first of all, we thought, well, it's going to be obvious. I mean, that was like the biggest challenge because he changed physically so quickly. He lost probably something like 200 pounds, I think. He was pretty large when we started, and he was tiny when we ended.
Yeah, he went from like 250 to 80.
Wow.
Yeah.
Mm.
But the risk is, you know, it can be powerful stuff, but then you start making a film about somebody who's dying of cancer.
Right.
And in this case, if you're honest about what the story is, that's really not what the story is. And we didn't want it to be too manipulative because, I mean, for us it was intense, but, you know, as a documentary filmmaker, there's always that question of how far are you going to go? Is there a line that you don't cross in your involvement? I think personally, in a situation like that, we knew that we just had to either stop or go all the way. And we just decided to stay, basically, to stay.
Yeah, I mean, I think we crossed every line because we were also his friend in terms of getting involved and trying to help him also. And like Frank said, we were just trying to find a very careful balance between this is what's happening in his life, but not trying to manipulate the audience and trying to make a tearjerker of somebody dying of cancer. This was about his life, not about his death.
I mean, this probably sounds somewhat callous, but I know how journalists and probably documentarians think. And was there any feeling on your part like we'd better hurry because he's not going to last and we want it more? I don't know if you thought of that at all as that went on.
I think part of what was hard for us is that we were so involved in his life and his mother's life that we were more worried about that after he passed away, really, because we were like, what didn't we get? What are we missing? Because we hadn't started editing yet. So I think that because we hadn't started working with the material yet, we had no idea what we had missed that we couldn't go back and get. And that was kind of nerve-wracking in like 2007.
But you obviously had enough to make the film. And so then at some point, and I guess he passed away in 2006, and you're still working on the film in 2012.
Yes.
So editing, I guess?
Well, his mother passed away 9 months after he did, and we were still very close with her. So I guess you could just kind of say the remaining part of 2006 and 2007, it was almost like a lost year of us just sort of being in sort of a dark place. We weren't quite ready to dive into the edit, and we were also trying to figure out, okay, who are all these other people that the dog's been telling us about and that we had started phone calls with that we have to film? So all of that material, we only started gathering in probably late 2007 and we started cutting. But like I said before, I mean, Frank and I, with all of our jobs, it was very sporadic. You know, people remember our film, but like from a decade ago. And I think there was just like a bunch of years that Frank and I just stopped talking to people about it because we're like, oh, we're those people that still have this project.
I know somebody who went to medical school while we were making this film.
And now they're a neurosurgeon.
Now they're a surgeon. It's amazing.
You're listening to The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Frank Corodrin and Allison Berg, who made the new documentary, The Dog. After many struggles to get their film made, the two faced an entirely unexpected challenge in 2012 in the form of Superstorm Sandy. The filmmakers rushed to protect their equipment in a waterfront Brooklyn studio, but didn't worry about their master tapes safely stored away in Manhattan. But then they heard about unexpected flooding in that area.
Nobody had ever thought that water would get there. And of course, our storage unit with all of our film and all the material for the film was in the basement.
And they wouldn't let us in for days.
Yeah, we couldn't go. We just knew it was underwater and that's it and we'll call you. So we were just completely I mean, the level of stress was intense. And what happened is it did get flooded. It was underwater, but our tapes were in a safe.
A sentry safe. I love them. I will plug them for this one.
Sentry safe.
And so, I mean, they survived, basically, which was completely amazing. And then we knew, because when it happened, we were like, okay, this is a sign for sure. It's either a sign that we should have never made this film, and basically it's an act of God that puts an end to this foolishness, or it's a sign that we have to finish this film.
I wonder if a couple of things. Do you feel comfortable telling us how much this ended up costing financially?
Well, it's like a mid-range budget. So I think for documentaries, it could go anywhere from like $10,000 to like $1 million or more, and we're sort of somewhere in the middle.
Mm. And then, I mean, you don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but you were a couple and then you weren't a couple. How do you handle that?
I don't really know. I mean, Well, go ahead.
Well, I mean, we both kind of fell down the rabbit hole with this project. We were like obsessed. So I think for both of us, there was no question. We knew we wanted to continue making the film.
I mean, we do have couples on the show periodically, and we ask them how they work together. And this is the first time I've, you know, encountered one where in the middle of the thing, I don't know how far along you were, but obviously it's a big change. And you just really just said, well, whatever happens, you get the dog, but we both keep the film.
We both kept the dog.
Yeah, No, I mean, I think there's something about when you've lived through those years and you want to finish it. Although, I mean, that's the other interesting thing is you have to be with somebody that you can argue with in a constructive way. Like, I think for us, there's like some back and forth, but it makes it better creatively. So I think we both recognize that, and you know, it's a rare thing.
It wasn't awkward. It was like great to be working together again and to be working on the film. You know, it's just something we enjoyed.
Yeah, I think also on a project like this, you're going to lose your mind. It's as simple as that. And if you're going to spend that many years and you're locked in an edit room and you're paying for it yourself, you're going to lose your mind. Any filmmaker would know that. So it's like if you're with somebody that you know very well, it kind of helps going through that because you don't have to be professional. You just have to get through it.
You can just do whatever. So how is the distribution thing worked out? I mean, do you feel that you're gonna be made whole financially or more than made whole? Can you tell at this stage?
I think it's too early to tell in the sense that because the film is out in theaters and on video on demand and all the digital platforms, it takes a much longer time to get some feedback as to how it's doing because you don't get those numbers about VOD and digital platforms for a while. So we don't know yet.
Yeah, I mean, we're not out of the woods. Yeah. It would be great if we could pay off.
We're deep in the forest right
now. Yeah, we're in it.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. So hopefully the credit cards at least because the interest rates and all, you know,
oh,
I mean,
yeah.
we're hoping.
But
yeah.
But there's something that's already happened that makes it that, you know, not everything is money. Like for us, what's great is we finished the film. It got out there. We had an amazing festival run. And, you know, there's distributors who like the film enough that they want to put it out there. I mean, that's a huge accomplishment for an independent film in and of itself.
Yeah, especially because after all these years, I mean, the fact that we're getting the kind of press we are now, it's really gratifying because for so long it was just us believing in the film. And so this feels really great now. And that you can't really put a price on that one, that other people are understanding what we were trying to tell.
Filmmakers Alison Berg and Frank Carradine's documentary is called The Dog. It's available at Amazon, iTunes, among other places. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.